Our speaker today is Dr. William Pierce, the chairman of the National Alliance, which is the world's foremost organization working for the long-term interest of white Americans and for people of European ancestry wherever they may live.
Hello. To most people, statistics don't have much meaning. They're just numbers. Tell people that 50 years ago, 90% of the citizens of the United States were white, that today only 70% are white, and that 50 years hence, less than half the U.S. population will be white, and it doesn't move most of them. They can't remember what it was like 50 years ago when the United States was unquestionably a white man's country, and they don't have enough imagination to visualize what it will be like when whites are a minority and are completely at the mercy of blacks, Asians, mestizos, and Jews. Tell most people about this trend toward a darker and darker America, and they will just shrug. They don't see how America's changing demographics will affect what they can buy at the mall or watch on television. What is happening to America is happening so slowly that they aren't alarmed. That's most people. In a few places in America, however, the changes are occurring more rapidly, and people are forced to pay attention. Many of these people are alarmed. I receive letters every week from listeners who lament what has happened to the towns or the neighborhoods they grew up in. They tell me that 15 years ago, every family in their neighborhood was white. The streets were clean and safe. They could leave their doors unlocked without worry. Their kids could walk to school or play with other kids in the neighborhood in safety. They could take a stroll in the evening with a wife or a girlfriend without danger of having lewd comments directed at them. Today, half their neighborhood has become non-white. Streets and yards are littered with trash. Bars have been installed on all first floor windows. Their kids get beaten up and have their lunch money stolen, and no white man in his right mind will expose his woman to the catcalls and deliberate jostling by non-white thugs who roam the streets and hang out in the malls. We've come to expect changes of this sort in the decaying cities of the East Coast, or in California, or Florida, or Texas, where the impact of non-white immigration has been especially heavy during the past few decades. But the white heartland also is being corrupted now. In fact, there is a deliberate campaign to corrupt and pollute the white heartland as quickly as possible. Iowa is an excellent example of this. One of the whitest states in the country, a land of corn-fed, blue-eyed, blonde farm boys and girls, Iowa is looked upon with undisguised hatred and distrust by the multicultural planners and diversity mongers of the East Coast. From their point of view, Iowa, with less than 3% minorities in 1990, was far too white, far too Aryan. Something really had to be done about Iowa. And so they're doing it with the help of their natural allies in the state house, in the Christian churches, in big business, and in the media. Under Iowa's new Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, state officials have launched a campaign to bring more non-whites into Iowa. Recruiting teams are sent to ghettos and barrios around the country to persuade blacks and mestizos to move to Iowa. The government in Washington is pumping money into a number of special programs in Iowa to help the process of multiculturalization. Non-whites are even being recruited in Mexico, Africa, and other non-white areas, and then brought to Iowa as government-approved immigrants. A story which appeared last month, that was May 4th, in the Chicago Tribune, praising the efforts to darken Iowa, contained interviews with several of these non-white immigrants, including a physician from Ghana married to a white woman, a meatpacking plant employee from Puerto Rico married to a Filipina, and a high school student from Laos. Governor Vilsack and the other politicians justify this program to racially pollute Iowa with the argument that Iowa's population isn't growing fast enough through natural increase. Iowa's population increased by only 5.4% during the 1990s, while the population of the country as a whole increased by 9.6%. Without a faster growth in population, claim the multiculturalizers, the economy will be hurt. The pretense is made that there will be no one to do essential jobs. The Chicago Tribune quotes Governor Vilsack. Who is going to farm the land? Who is going to teach our children? Who is going to care for our medical needs? This same spurious argument is being used by the enemies of our people in Europe to justify opening the borders of European countries to the third world. Europeans aren't breeding fast enough to maintain the various welfare programs and social services needed to provide for an aging white population. So fast-breeding third worlders should be brought in to keep the population growing, say the multiculturalizers. Of course, any scheme which depends upon a continually growing population must eventually come to grief when the land can support no more people. Did you catch that? Any plan, any program which requires a continually growing population for its success is fundamentally flawed and eventually must fail. But the people pushing such schemes onto a gullible white public don't really care about the long-range prospects. For them, the scheme is simply a trick to get as many non-whites as possible mixed in with the white population as quickly as possible. They believe that once they have done that, it will be too difficult, too bloody a task for us to unmix what they have mixed. They will be surprised at what we are willing to do to repair the damage they have done. Listen, if Iowans need more teachers and doctors, the law of supply and demand will take care of that. Iowans may have to offer higher pay to attract needed white workers from other parts of the country, but that is the way things always have worked. The argument that non-whites are necessary to keep the economy alive is fraudulent. But the politicians, the Christian churches, the big businessmen, and above all the media, the untouchable Jewish media, are supporting this fraud, this genocidal lie, and few citizens in Europe or in Iowa are bold enough to challenge it. The fact is that much of the 5.4% increase in Iowa's population during the 1990s has been mestizos brought in by the owners of meatpacking plants looking for cheap labor. This has resulted in those Iowa communities with meatpacking plants being especially hard hit by the multicultural onslaught. Storm Lake, a town of 10,000 residents in northwestern Iowa, is an example. In 1990, Storm Lake was virtually all white, a nice place to live and raise a family. Today, a third of Storm Lake's residents are non-white, and the quality of life has changed accordingly. In all of the 1980s, there was just one homicide in Storm Lake. Between 1990 and 2000, as the town went from all white to one-third non-white, there were 10 murders, and other crime also rose proportionately. This sudden destruction of their community and their lifestyle in the course of only a decade shocked a few of Storm Lake's white residents into speaking out. The multiculturalists have responded by bringing their roadshow to town, proclaiming Storm Lake a wonderful example of how a diverse group of people can live and work together, and denouncing anyone who doesn't want to go along with the continued destruction of Iowa as a racist and a bigot. With the Christian clergy and the media noisily on their side, and the big businessmen providing support from behind the scenes, the multiculturalists have been moderately successful at shouting down the dissidents, even in heavily impacted areas such as Storm Lake. The local high school students raised on MTV have been taught that a white Iowa is a boring Iowa, and that having lots of non-whites around adds some buzz to an otherwise dull life. The Chicago Tribune article I cited earlier had an interview with a 17-year-old white high school girl in Storm Lake. Looking around at the non-whites who make up nearly half of her high school classmates, Jill Parman said, and I quote, "I know that Iowa doesn't look like this, but it would be a whole lot less boring of a state if it did." Thoroughly jaded young people such as Jill Parman, taught by television that life should, above all else, be entertaining, are quite susceptible to the poison disseminated by the multiculturalists. And the multiculturalists are indeed proud of their ability to use their control of the mass media, especially television, to take over the minds of the younger generation and alienate them from their people and from their people's traditions and values. They have become quite self-confident, arrogant really, in their ability to keep dissent within manageable limits as they continue their genocidal work. An even better example of this than Storm Lake is the small town of Postville in northeastern Iowa. Postville is undergoing an even more traumatic racial and cultural transformation than Storm Lake. A decade ago, Postville was an all-white, all-Christian farming community of 1,000 souls, most of German and Norwegian ancestry. Then Aaron Rubashkin, a Hasidic Jew who owns a kosher meat market for supplying his fellow Hasids in New York City, opened a kosher slaughterhouse in Postville. He had bought Postville's bankrupt meatpacking plant from its Gentile owners and converted it to kosher use because he could get his meat slaughtered much more cheaply in Postville than in New York, even when the cost of shipping the meat from Iowa to New York was included. Today, he and his son Shalom run the slaughterhouse, which employs 300 workers, nearly all of them non-whites, recruited by Aaron and Shalom outside Iowa and brought to Postville specifically to work in the slaughterhouse. They also brought more than 30 ultra-Orthodox rabbis and their families to town. The rabbis do the actual slaughtering of the animals according to Jewish ritual, a shockingly inhumane procedure which has been outlawed in many jurisdictions. The white people of Postville feel overwhelmed. Their town has been stolen from them. 10 years ago, everyone they met on the sidewalk or in the local pizza parlor was a neighbor, someone they had gone to school with, someone they shared values and traditions with. Now they see Orthodox Jews wearing black hats and prayer shawls and talking to each other in Hebrew. They see Mexicans and Nigerians and Vietnamese lounging against the lampposts and jabbering at one another in other strange languages. They see their schools, which used to be entirely white, swamped with dusky aliens. But it is the Jews who are the most difficult for the people of Postville to accept. The Jews are all from New York City. They are loud and pushy. They are fast-talking hustlers. They are arrogant. They make no effort to adapt themselves to the ways of Postville. Instead, they demand that Postville adapt itself to them. They even ignore the local laws with contempt. the Lubashkins dumped the waste from their kosher slaughterhouse into the local river, polluting it so badly that it no longer is suitable for fishing or swimming or boating. Postville imposed a $2 million fine on the Lubashkins, who simply refused to pay and keep on polluting, knowing that the governor and the media are on their side. And, unfortunately, some of the white people of Postville are on their side, too. The city council members, for example, and the people at the local newspaper. The newspaper hired a Jewess to write a regular column. When there was a vacancy on the city council, the council members appointed a Jew to the council, saying that it would be good for the local economy. When local citizens circulated a petition protesting the appointment, they were accused of anti-Semitism by the newspaper. That intimidated most of the white citizens into silence, but not 81-year-old Dorothy Radloff. She said that she didn't want a Jew on the city council. She went further, saying what many other whites in Postville were feeling but were afraid to say, and I quote, "We're just afraid if they get one in, then pretty soon the whole council will be Jewish, and they're going to run the town. They're working to take the town over and push the rest of us out." End of quote. But with the support of the newspaper and the other council members and the mayor, the Jew, Aaron Goldsmith, won a special election 2 months ago. There's something about politicians and journalists, and the gullibility and blind tolerance of our people for getting kicked in the teeth and not fighting back seem to know no limits. Perhaps if the white citizens of Postville, Iowa, had known a little more about the Hasidic Jews who are taking over their town and flooding it with non-whites, besides the fact that they are pushy and arrogant, the election to the city council might have turned out differently. The Lubashkins and the other Jews associated with the kosher slaughterhouse all are members of the ultra-Orthodox Lubavitcher sect. The Lubavitchers are those strange-looking Jews one sees in New York wearing long black coats and black hats with sideburns down to their shoulders. The late leader of the sect, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, was worshipped like a divinity by his followers, including the Lubashkins and all of the other Jews they brought to Postville. Rabbi Schneerson was a real Old Testament Jew, a Talmud Jew, who preached to his followers the unadulterated doctrines of the Talmud, including the doctrine of Jewish superiority and the doctrine that the Jews are the chosen people of God, ordained to rule all the other nations of the world and own all their possessions. His sermons have been published, although you're not likely to find them in the New York Times or any other place where Gentiles might read them. But I'll read you a selection from one of them just to give you the flavor. Rabbi Schneerson preached, and I quote, "The body of a Jewish person is of a totally different quality from the body of a member of any other nation of the world. The Jewish body looks as if in substance it were similar to the bodies of non-Jews, but the bodies only seem to be similar in material substance, outward look, and superficial quality. The difference of the inner quality, however, is so great that the bodies should be considered as completely different species. This is the reason why the Talmud states that there is an halakhic difference in attitude about the bodies of non-Jews. Their bodies are in vain. An even greater difference exists in regard to the soul. Two contrary types of soul exist. A non-Jewish soul comes from three satanic spheres, while the Jewish soul comes from holiness." End of quote. Well, Rabbi Schneerson had much more to say in his preaching to his followers about the satanic nature of Gentiles and the holy nature of the Jews, but perhaps you've gotten the general idea from what I've just read. The general idea is that Jewish superiority has been bestowed on them by their deity. The Jews are so superior to us that they are justified in doing to us whatever they want. They are entitled to deceive us and plunder us and take all our possessions from us. And it is a transgression against their deity for us to attempt to protect ourselves. That's what the Hasids believe. That's what the Rubashkins and all the other Jews in Postville believe. It's too bad that there was no one to tell the white citizens of Postville what the Jews really think about them before they elected one of the Jews to their city council. Perhaps Dorothy Radloff had some inkling of the truth when she told her fellow citizens, "They are working to take the town over and push the rest of us out." Indeed. Unfortunately, too many of her fellow citizens failed to heed her warning. They listened instead to their Christian preachers and their local politicians and their newspaper. They have, for all practical purposes, lost their town. They are too confused and demoralized and disunited to put up an effective opposition to the Jews. And if they really started to clean up their town and take it back, Mr. Bush would send in the FBI to stop them. They would be arrested and charged with hate crimes. At this point, we might ask, why are the Jews and their allies doing it? Why are they hell-bent on destroying white areas like Iowa? Why aren't they satisfied with what they have done to California and to the big cities of the East? Why do they want to make the whole country look like New Jersey and New York? Why do they deliberately destroy all white communities such as Storm Lake and Postville? I'll read you a few words written by Professor Earl Robb of Brandeis University's Institute for Jewish Advocacy. I quote, "The Census Bureau has just reported that about half of the American population will soon be non-white or non-European, and they will all be American citizens. We have tipped beyond the point where a Nazi Aryan party will be able to prevail in this country. We have been nourishing the American climate of opposition to ethnic bigotry for about half a century. That climate has not yet been perfected, but the heterogeneous nature of our population tends to make it irreversible." End of quote. In plain language, Professor Robb is boasting that he and his fellow Jews have changed the immigration laws and prevented the government from enforcing what immigration laws we still have in order to make the American population more heterogeneous, or, to use the more familiar term, more diverse. Their goal is to make whites a minority in their own country so that the whites can never combine against the Jews and regain control of their own destiny. You can read more of Professor Robb's sinister scheming in a book which is available from my sponsor, National Vanguard Books. That book is Alien Nation by Peter Brimlow. Professor Robb and his fellow Jews aim not only at eliminating the white majority in the country as a whole, but also at polluting and corrupting every white area inside the country, so there will be no one capable of organizing an effective opposition to the Jews. They will be the only racially conscious group still able to wield power. What the Jews have done to Postville and are busy doing to the rest of Iowa is just one step in their grand scheme for implementing a final solution to the Gentile problem. This final solution is not being implemented with concentration camps and gas chambers, but with bought politicians, with corrupt preachers, and above all, with television and other mass media. It is being implemented by flooding the country and every white area inside the country with non-whites and by encouraging miscegenation. It is being implemented through programs aimed at increasing diversity. It is being implemented by deceiving and brainwashing white people to collaborate in their own destruction. The hour for our people is late indeed, but it's still not too late. It's still not too late to fight back. Thanks for being with me again today.
You have been listening to a presentation of American Dissident Voices. The speaker was Dr. William Pierce, chairman of the National Alliance. The program was sponsored as a public service by National Vanguard Books, America's foremost supplier of patriotic books and tapes. For $2, we'll send you our newest 72-page illustrated catalog with descriptions and ordering information for more than 600 books and tapes of interest to patriots. Many of the items in the National Vanguard Books catalog are available nowhere else. Our mailing address is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.